Anything you say is going to become picked up by a microphone, so you better be careful. There are some people last year who thought it was wonderful that we audio recorded lectures. Personally, I can't imagine listening to me twice, but that's okay. I guess if you ramp it up to double speed, it's more tolerable. But I know Emily's not making it back, so at least for her, it'll be available. I will get them on the website, the pharmacology website, which is in the syllabus at the bottom of the top page. Probably not today, but tomorrow at least. In terms of the syllabus, the objectives of the overall course are there on the front page. You'll see that there's a lot that's involved. Pharmacology often is more of a vocabulary course. It's more like learning a foreign language than it is science. Oh yeah, we use science, but it seems like every time we turn around, there's another $100 name to have to learn. And some of these names are kind of crazy. At the hospital, most of the docs run around using brand names, but for step one and also for many practices now, especially with the insurance companies nosing in and telling you how to practice medicine, they always want the generics prescribed. So you're going to see generic names, you're going to see brand names in all that we do. What I will try to do is give you both, unless it's truly just a generic, and that's the only name you really need to know, and then you'll have it. For the exams you're going to use the generic names. The first couple of exams actually have both names on them, but by the time I get to the third exam, I quit giving the brand names because sometimes the brand names tell you what the drugs are. You know, breathing sounds like it might be something that could be used for asthma and help your breathing, and you're right. So rather than have that as a giveaway, the brand names have been taken off. But if you ask me, is this that, then I'll tell you yeah. Because I don't want you missing a question because you can't remember the brand name or the generic. In terms of who's going to be with you this fall, there are only two of us. I'm going to go the first half of the semester, then Dr. Bozine is going to come in the second half. And he'll be dealing with the chemotherapy of bacterial, mycobacterial, fungal, viral, and so forth, infections. And so there's a whole slew of drugs that are used in there. For my part, we're going to go through basic principles, then on into autonomics, from autonomics into the cardiovascular system, renal, pulmonary, let's get rid of cholesterol, and then Bozine's going to come in. For the next few weeks, it's going to be a very fast pace. If you turn over to about the fourth page, you'll notice that for the fall semester, the first week, we only have three classes, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So the Friday's an extra one. It's at the hospital. I will do my best to make that an hour. It's lethal lecturing at that time of the day. For me, I'm sure it is for you too. The following week, you'll know we've got Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday. Now that Friday, the 31st, if you guys bear with me and I can blast in a hurry, then we'll see if we can have Friday afternoon before Labor Day off, since you don't get Labor Day. We don't get Labor Day either. This dumb university and thinking that it needs to have class on Monday. So we do. But then after that, as you can see, the rest of the course, after about the third week, becomes a Monday-Wednesday course, which is kind of normal. So for the graduate students, you know, welcome to the course. I realize that that's going to put a kink in your style, but we are going to audio record as much as possible at the hospital. They have said they'll help me. So hopefully, if you can't make them, those will be available too. And if not, as I told you before, grab some notes, okay? All right, what about the course itself? There are two textbooks that are listed, and I didn't bring them, but we got them right here. Okay. Some lectures are great in Lippincott. Some lectures are great in Katzen. Some of my lectures kind of come out of this. A few come out of this. Bozine kind of really likes this. Phil Quirk in the spring, I think, kind of likes this, but he likes the questions in this. So what am I telling you? I'm telling you that you should buy one. You should look at the book. You should decide what your learning style prefers. The pictures in the Lippincott book are far superior for the most part. They're a little jazzier. And Katzing, on the other hand, has a lot more review questions. And so if you want to see questions, then this is helpful. This has more of an outline. This has a little more prose stuck in it. So there are pluses and minuses to both. What I will say is that we used to use the big version of Katzing, which is about an 1,800-page book with small print. So rather than harass you with trying to read that, we've gone to the review books. And so buy one, don't buy both of them. All right? Pick the one that you think is the best. The way this course operates is all of the exams will be coming out of the notes. So if there's a conflict, if you read one book and you see a conflict in the other book, because there are some are errors and some are the state of the knowledge is such that some people think this theory is better than that theory. Nevertheless, for you who are thinking it's going to be on the next exam and there's one best answer, which is right, it creates a hassle and a stress. So go by the notes. The notes are the end all. Okay. There are a couple of references that are listed for you. A to Z Drug Facts by Facts and Comparisons. I don't know if you've ever used Facts and Comparisons. It's a huge book. I split it up into two volumes, and they're both about like this. What they have done is it's an independent source of pharmacists, physicians, PharmDs that have sat down and tried to go through the medical literature and come up with a unbiased opinion of a given agent. If you look at the PDR, which a lot of people swear by, you got to understand the PDR is simply the product insert published by the manufacturer of the medicine. Consequently, legal department for that company has massaged that information. And so it does have some bias in it. So there is always the PDR. There's a new one coming out in November if you're interested in that. Facts and Comparisons, the one I have is a loose leaf. It's updated monthly. And they also have an online source. So not that you can get to it, because I can't get to it, because I wouldn't pay for it. But if you're in practice, it may be a good source of information. The other one that's... Whoops. I dropped the website. Okay. Another one that's a good site is called rxlist.com. Used to be this company would publish the top 200 drugs that are used in the United States. And now it's expanded beyond that because of the web capability. So The downside to this list is that drugs that are prescribed often, such as antibiotics, you get one prescription and then you come back, and if you needed a second round, you get a second prescription. So at the very top of this list, you see a lot of antibiotics. Whereas a compound that might be a chronic med, say somebody's taking, well, Zocor is up there very high, Lipitor is up there very high for cholesterol lowering. Those are on the list, but they're not as high simply because you tend to write a prescription and the patient stays on it until that dosage is no longer able to control their cholesterol. Then you raise their dose, you write a new script, or once a year you write a new script. So this is a tad biased by the number of prescriptions that are written. But nevertheless, it will show you a lot of different information on them. Has a good link to other drugs that are available in the same category. So if you're thinking about trying to substitute, it also has links to drug interactions. So it's a nice web-based information source, and it's free. Okay. Some people often ask, Why do we have to learn all these drugs? And there are a lot of them. And in the middle of the page one, it gives you a website for the knowledge objectives in medical pharmacology. So some individuals, in their infinite wisdom, have put together this list of compounds, including some nerve gases that we won't cover, but list of compounds that they think, you know, the average medical student should have to learn. And so that's basically where about 85% of this course comes from, is just meeting those objectives. So the bottom line is you will get the information you need in order to survive medical school and practice. Okay, how are we going to structure the course? On page two, we talk about examinations and grading procedures. So we say 3 2-hour exams. Okay, well, actually, the exam will start at 8 and end at 9:55, because it'll take a few minutes to get the late takers out of the room, and physiology will be standing in the hall. You remember last year when you were standing in the hall? Okay. So it's not really 2 hours. It's 1 hour and 55 minutes. If you have a learning disability or something like that where you need more time, then we need to talk. So you can just email me and we'll make a convenient time. The way these exams are set up, they have 60 two-point questions that are choose the one best answer. We have tried to learn to write questions in the national board style with clinical vignettes where you read all kinds of information and then you have to look and find the answer, and you're wondering when you start, oh, this is obviously, and then by the time you get to the bottom, you realize the question's asking something totally different. So read the entire question, please, before you think you know the answer. You'll find that it'll be helpful. And then 20% or 20 points of the question of the exam will be other things. For pharmacokinetics, which we'll get into a little later on, Wednesday, I guess, there'll be a problem for you to solve, so you'll need some numbers. I don't necessarily need you to have your calculator to give me the final number, but I certainly want to see the math on how you were going to get that final number. In other places, we might have short answer, we might have essays. I know on a lot of mine, I prefer that you write in an outline format rather than prose. It's easier for you, and it's a lot easier for me to grade, because normally on the questions, I'm looking for 2 or 3 points. And if you got the points, then you'll get the credit. And where you lose points is when you make a statement that's just not true. And so rather than end up with additional verbiage to fill up the space, it's okay to just have an outline. So anyway, that's the way that goes. In December, we'll have a cumulative final. I know you're going to moan, and I know you're going to groan, but the more you look at this stuff, the better. Somebody asked me one time, how do you survive this course? And I said, well, to me, it was kind of like organic chemistry. I knew somebody would respond to that. I happen to have enjoyed organic, but in order to make organic make sense, we started out with some basics, and then you had to look at it every day. You know, I couldn't look at it the day before the exam and pack it all in and spit it back out. I had to do it on a daily basis. So about 1 hour a day was spent learning organic chemistry. My recommendation in pharmacology is that you do the same thing. Look over the notes. And in order to help you as an incentive, we're going to have daily pop quizzes. Some you might work together as a group. Some are going to be done as individuals. But the thought there is that you will come in from the previous day having looked at your notes. And so this is a little incentive to help you to look at them. Some of the questions are very thought-provoking. So they're not all, I can look at my notes and in 2 seconds I can get the answer. So some of them are going to be tough. And I just warn you ahead of time to expect that. The grading scale's there. I'm not going to talk about that. You can read that yourself. the very last item on the page. Cheating will not be tolerated. I've never been so mad in my life as when I sat in a chair in front of the class and watched a student copy off the person in front of her. .39 grade point. First year, all honors. She withdrew from school rather than have cheating thrown out for cheating on her record. So when we have the exams, I want to see the scantrons underneath your pages. If somebody's got it off to the side, I will say in the middle of the class, in front of everybody, so-and-so put that underneath. Okay? It's for your protection and the protection of the people around you. No temptation makes life a whole lot easier. All right? You guys are supposed to be professionals. You're supposed to act professionally. The knowledge in your brain should be your own. All right, assessments of competencies in pharmacology. We throw a lot of things in here, primarily because I was the guy that had to make the competency curriculum happen in Bloomington. We're going to keep it low-key, as I said on Friday. But we will do things throughout the course that you'll be able to go, I don't want to answer that dumb competency. Okay? But we'll get through it together, no problem. All right, any questions on the syllabus? Okay. All clear? Good. Okay. What about principles of pharmacology? We're going to start off today with basic principles, looking at really a lot of definitions. And then I've got a problem that I'll let you wrestle with a little bit. And we'll see how much you remember from freshman chemistry. Unfair. That's all right. We got two chemists in the room that'll help you if they need it, right? They're looking at me like, I don't know about that either. Okay. So if you think about pharmacology, it is not the study of the ecology of farms, but rather it's the study of drugs or chemicals on some kind of living system. And so as you can see there, with a number of definitions, a drug could be a substance that acts on living systems at the molecular level. It's probably the simplest definition I've ever seen. But when we think about drugs, what are we talking about? We can talk about a molecule as small as lithium, which is used in the treatment of bipolar disease. Or we can talk about peptides that are used in a number of areas. So we can go from very small to very, very large molecules. Some enzymes are in excess of 50,000 Daltons, things that bust up clots. But most of the drugs are going to be in a molecular weight range really of about 100 to 1,000. And the rationale for that is pretty simple. And that is that in order to get to the active site where it has to work, say into the active site of an enzyme or in the site where a transport can occur and that sort of thing, and in order to get the specificity that you want, it tends to be a smaller molecule. There are exceptions to that. When drugs bind to receptors, what kind of mechanisms happen downstream? You can't list them all. Before we get to the end of the course, you'll learn probably 75 to 100 different ways that chemicals can interact with a living system to produce a response. So there's a whole host of different mechanisms that we'll talk about. When we think of medical pharmacology in particular, we're really focusing on drugs that will act and help in either the diagnosis or treatment of disease, or maybe prevention of disease. But there are a lot of different agents that are used in veterinary medicine, a lot of different agents that can be used in the treatment of insecticides and things like that, which some might argue is no longer pharmacology but gets into toxicology. In terms of toxicology, it's really the study of the adverse effects. Now, sometimes people say, well, an adverse effect is really just a side effect. Well, that's not what we mean in toxicology. In toxicology, we're talking about truly deleterious effects of chemicals. You know, death. Okay. When you take an anticholinergic drug, you can't pee, you can't see, your mouth dries up. That's kind of simple. Those are side effects. Those are nuisances. Those have little lethality associated with them. So when we're thinking of toxicology, we're talking about truly adverse effects. What about drug receptors? Drug receptors, when I was coming along, was just this nebulous term of something that the drug hit on a membrane. Of course, we've gone a long way from there. We know all kinds of different receptors. We know we've got the molecular biology to talk about the genes that are involved. We know what the products are. We know what the structures of many receptors are. Very, very complex chemistry going on. And the interaction between the drug and the receptor is a fascinating area of study as well, as people try to make new drugs with more and more specificity and hopefully fewer side effects by studying how one molecule can interface with another. So, drug receptors, loosely defined as a molecular component of the body that directly interacts with the drug to bring about its effects. You'll also hear two terms a lot: pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics. Now, if you think back to the original Greek word, kinetic really means rate. So how fast do things occur? And so when we talk about pharmacokinetics, we're often talking about things like absorption, distribution, metabolism, excretion. So if you think about it in a chart, you can have absorption into the systemic circulation. From here, the drug can go into, say, tissues to bind receptors and produce an effect. It can come off of that site and go back into the circulation. We could also go into organs where biotransformation can occur. If biotransformation occurs, you can get metabolites. Metabolites can go back into the systemic circulation, or they can go and be excreted from the body. So when we think of pharmacokinetics, we're talking about how well does a chemical move from one site to another in this kind of schema. So if you like to deal with the math and the rate constants that are involved, each one of these arrows can have a rate constant, and you can define it all mathematically. And we'll do a little bit of that in the course, but not too much. Primary sites of biotransformation are going to be the liver, the kidney, and the intestine. We'll talk more about that also. Metabolites, you need to remember, can be active as well as inactive. So sometimes you may have a drug that is activated, or you might have a drug that is converted from an active agent to an active metabolite. And so when you think of how long is it active in the body, you've got to add the length of time for the parent drug plus the metabolite. Case in point is propranolol, a beta blocker. Major site of excretion is going to be the kidney out in the urine. There is fecal excretion as well. It is possible for some things to get metabolized and blown off in the air. Possible to have things go out through the skin, through the hair, things of that nature, but the primary sites are going to be fecal and urinary elimination. So pharmacokinetics concerns itself with how drugs move around in the body and how these different processes impact on them. Okay. The other term that we often talk about is pharmacodynamics. Pharmacodynamics is talking about the study of the effects of the drugs on the body. In other words, what is the drug-receptor interaction? Can we define that? Are there dose-response phenomena? So we'll show you some dose-response curves where we're looking at some kind of a response with some kind of a dose. In this case, it's log of dose concentration. Because as you increase dose, theoretically, you get increased response, but at some point it flattens out because the system can't respond to it anymore. Okay? So pharmacodynamics is also worried about things like therapeutic and toxic interactions, or therapeutic and toxic actions of the agent by itself. Sometimes we'll talk about pharmacodynamic tolerance versus pharmacokinetic tolerance. Now, at this point in your careers, what's tolerance? Yes, sir?
How much you can take before you're worse off?
Okay, it's one way to think about it. Yes? Okay. So when we're thinking pharmacologically, Travis's answer is a little better than Kyle's. We're thinking about a decreased response to the same dose after the patient's taken it over and over and over again. If you think about pharmacodynamic tolerance, what's happening? The drug's in the body, but the system isn't responding like it used to. If you think about pharmacokinetic tolerance, it may be that biotransformation gets increased so that the drug gets peed out of the body, so elimination increases also, so the drug gets peed out more quickly, and hence it can't do its job. So you're going to hear these terms, pharmacodynamic and pharmacokinetic, used throughout the course. So recognize their differences, please. Okay. What are some pharmacodynamic principles that you need to remember? Again, this goes back to kind of freshman chemistry, although you probably had it in biochem too. Chemicals that interact with other chemicals have the ability to form chemical bonds. So we can talk about covalent bonding. We can talk about all kinds of electrostatic bonding. And how do those things differ? And why are they important? Let's say you have two drugs. Let's say they have the ability to form an insoluble salt together. And let's say you take them at the same time. What's going to happen to the efficacy of the drugs? It's going to go down. Why? So absorption's impacted. The chemical's not getting absorbed. So by absorption, we mean that it's getting into the bloodstream, so it's able to go systemically. So if you take two chemicals and they react in your stomach to form an insoluble salt, absorption can't occur. So think about bonding. When we think about a drug interacting with a receptor, let's say acetylcholine binding to the nicotinic receptor. Which one? Let's say the neuromuscular nicotinic receptor. What happens? Is charge important? Or what about the cholinomimetic agents, acetylcholine binding to acetylcholine esterase. That's right, but it sounds weird. Acetylcholine esterase. What happens to the esterase? The esterase binds to specific charged sites on the acetylcholine. So there's a lot of that that we can talk about, and we will as we go through it. We also know that drugs can react with water, other drugs, biochemical messengers and mediators, and so all of these may involve some covalent interactions. They may involve hydrostatic or hydrogen bonding type interacting, van der Waals interactions, and that may have an impact on their functionality. And we'll talk about that as well. Okay. When you think about specificity of action, we want this drug to bind this site and produce a specific response. Do you think a drug that has weaker binding or a drug that has stronger binding will be more selective? Generally, we say that a drug that has weaker binding is going to be a little more selective. But that's not that. That's obviously got a lot of exceptions to it. All right. Years ago, when people were studying the autonomic nervous system, and they were trying to understand how it was that if you stimulated this nerve, you could get this muscle to contract. And they started using poisons from plants or from animals. One of the things that they came to realize was that some agents seemed to act everywhere in the body and produced massive effects, most of which were deleterious. Even though they were trying to look at this one muscle contraction, if they gave this chemical systemically, all these other things happened too. So with time, people said, you know, if this is really going to be a good therapeutic agent, we need specificity. We need a compound that will bind to a one locus producing one effect. And so the medicinal chemist would say, okay, here's this structure, let's play with it. And let's stick a methyl group on where there was a hydrogen, or take away a hydroxyl and put an amine in there, or just all kinds of things. Or if we're dealing with, say, peptides, can you change a single amino acid and alter how well that particular agent will do what you're trying to do? So specificity is often determined then by the chemistry of the drug itself, by its structure. It's determined by the fit of the drug to its binding site. So if you change a drug from being negatively charged to positively charged, it may not bind. Or it may bind more avidly. So structure becomes really important. On page 3, we've got an example of amphetamine. Amphetamine is kind of an interesting chemical. First of all, it's found as a racemate. It's a racemic mixture. It's got a D form and an L form. Now you should be able to figure out which carbon is the chiral carbon. I know, that's, when was that? That was organic way back when. But why is that important? There are a lot of drugs out there where you've got D forms and L forms, and it turns out that the forms can differ significantly in their activities. For example, D-amphetamine is a CNS stimulant. That's the stuff everybody really likes. It boosts the CNS without really hitting the cardiovascular system. But if you get L-amphetamine, you kick the heart into overdrive, you kick the intestinal system into overdrive, you kick the CNS into overdrive, which may be what you wanted, but all of a sudden you've got palpations, you got blood pressures that are going out the roof. So you can have significant side effects. One of the problems the pharmaceutical industry really has is, okay, we've got this racemate. Can we separate it? With some chemicals, it's far too expensive to separate the racemates and to try to produce a specific one. So what happens is you end up prescribing a dirtier drug because the cost of separating the D and L forms is just way too high. We know that L-epinephrine is far more potent than D-epinephrine in all of its actions. There's a compound called sotalol, which happens to be a beta blocker in one of its racemates and a calcium channel blocker in the other, or a potassium channel blocker in the other. Totally different properties. And yes, sir. Well, you got D and L forms, you got chiral. What D is what? Dextrorotatory, and L is levorotatory. So it does shift the lights. You can have pluses and minuses. Doesn't matter which way they're going. The point I'm trying to make is that you've got chemicals that are in use today as active drugs that are mixtures. Those mixtures have distinct properties. And until industry can find an inexpensive way to separate those, you're going to be prescribing dirtier drugs than you might otherwise have to. Ibuprofen is another mix of plus and minus that let me get this backwards. Matter doesn't. The plus form, I think, has all of the pharmacological properties as an anti-inflammatory. The minus is inactive. But again, the cost of separating it is too high. But why separate it if the minus form doesn't do anything? That's no big deal. But in the case of amphetamine, where the minus form is hitting the cardiovascular system, ramping up blood pressure, ramping up all kinds of systems other than just the CNS, you've got a lot of side effects that you don't want. So the point is simply that it is something that you'll never think about it as a practitioner, probably, but you should. As far as I know, there's not a single ibuprofen prep out there that only has one form. I don't think so. I think the chemical synthesis is such that you end up with the same mixture every time you make it. But I don't know that. Okay. Where am I? There's another property about amphetamine that we'll come back to later on. It's a weak base. It has a pKa of about 9.8. When you think about a weak base or a weak acid, you think about pKa's, what are we ultimately leading up to? Happens to be on the next page and we'll not get there yet. But why is that important? You can think of buffering issues, but just as a pharmacodynamic principle, uncharged species move across membranes well, charged species don't. So that's something else to think about. Okay. Two terms that you're going to hear a lot all the way through the course. Drugs are agonists or antagonists. So what's an agonist? You should know already. Binds and works. The antagonist binds and doesn't. Okay. Doesn't necessarily bind to the same site, though, as the agonist. The antagonist could bind someplace else and still block the effects of an agonist. When we think about chemistry and pharmacokinetics, What are some properties of a chemical that might impact the rate by which it moves around? Size is important, you bet. Charge. Hydration, or in a more global thinking, its overall shape. We could talk about its hydrophilicity versus lipophilicity. There are a lot of different properties that we could think about. Some people say that permeation is the movement of drug molecules into and within the biologic environment. So sometimes you'll hear that term, permeation, the movement of drug molecules within the biologic environment. But when we think of movement, what are we really thinking about? It's got to go across a membrane. So let's say you swallow a pill. What has to happen? If it doesn't get absorbed into the bloodstream, and you don't really care if it works on the gut, then if it stays in the gut, it's not efficacious. It can't get to where it needs to go. And so understanding how things cross membranes is important. What are some different mechanisms? Well, you know all these. Aqueous diffusion. So the simple movement of molecules through a watery extra and intracellular spaces. Aqueous diffusion is passive, doesn't require energy. Common for small molecules up to maybe 30 kilodaltons, in fact, with small proteins. So when you think of the aqueous diffusion, what might things go through? What might things go through? Pores. So you got water channels, the aquaporins, for example, things like that. What about lipid diffusion? When we think of lipid diffusion, we're thinking more of dissolution in and movement through a lipid membrane. So here's something that is fat soluble. It has no trouble getting into the membrane and diffusing through it. Once again, lipid diffusion is passive. And so which molecules would move most quickly? Uncharged molecules, nonpolar molecules. The third item on that list is special carriers. What kind of carriers exist? There are families of proteins of carriers for organic anions, organic cations. There's a whole family of P-glycoprotein transporters. And what do we know about these special carriers? They're capacity limited. So the amount of carrier influences how much you can move across. They often require energy. And many of these transporters actually function for endogenous substances, and drugs just simply use them because they're the appropriate size and shape that they fit and can be transported by them. So there are a whole host of specialized carriers that one could think about. And as we go through this course, we'll get into some of them, and we'll talk about agents that actually block carrier function. The final thing that we could consider in terms of getting a drug across a membrane involves endocytosis or exocytosis. So, depending on which way you want to get it, into or out of a system. So, internalization by the infolding of an area of the plasma membrane would be endocytosis. You can get huge substances across that way. Or lipid-insoluble agents you can get into the cell this way. So an example might be that vitamin B12 binds with intrinsic factor, or iron binding with transferrin. So there can be endocytosis, or in the case of moving it out of the cell, exocytosis. Now, is all that clear? I know that's kind of fast, but you've had it all before, right? Okay. The final thing to think about is this so-called Fick's law. What is Fick's law of diffusion? What do you need to remember about it? The equation is basically given in the handout for you. So Fick's law says that diffusion rate is a function of the concentration gradient, or C1 minus C2. So that's the concentration gradient, times the permeability coefficient. This is going to be a very specific value for a specific agent. So you might say, well, it'll probably differ then for every agent, and it does. Divided by the thickness in terms of the membrane itself, and times the surface area. So what are some examples for this? Think about the lung. How easy is it for certain gases to cross the lung? Let's talk oxygen, let's talk carbon dioxide. They move real fast. Why? You got small molecule, huge surface area. Okay, so surface area being very large, thickness being small, things can move rapidly. If you think of the stomach versus the intestine, major difference here would be surface area size again. Tremendous surface area in the small intestine in contrast to the gut, and we'll just forget the pH differences and all that stuff. Also, gastric mucosa is not really designed to transport a lot of stuff in, whereas the intestine is constantly moving stuff in, so there are a lot more transporters and things of that nature. So we can think about differences there. Yes, sir, Nick? It's unique for every agent. Smaller molecules tend to move a little faster, unless there's a specific carrier system available for them. But if it's just passive diffusion, then smaller moves better than larger. Okay. So, for Fick's law, what do you need to remember? Think about surface area versus thickness of the membrane that the drug is trying to cross. Okay. Another important factor that we need to think about is this one, called the Henderson-Hasselbalch. Now, you remember this, right? All right. What do you need to remember? Principle number one, charge form. Much less lipid soluble. So, what is the charged form of a weak acid? It is the unprotonated form. So it has lost the proton. So it's negatively charged. What about the acid? A weak base. So if it's protonated, then it's got a positive, so it's a quaternary nitrogen now for a lot of bases. So protonated form of the weak base and unprotonated form of a weak acid are the charged forms, and they're less lipid soluble. So aqueous solubility depends on ionization, depends on polarity. Henderson-Hasselbalch says that the log of the protonated over the unprotonated is equal to the pK minus the pH. So you can work with numbers. If I were to give you a problem that had those numbers, you could solve it, right? Let's see, how many years ago was freshman chemistry? Well, let's talk a little bit about why it's important. Ion trapping can occur. Ion trapping is something that used to be done actually quite a bit. Some people say we should really do it now. And other people say, well, you know, it's got some risks associated with it, and maybe we shouldn't do it. But let's say you've got a chemical in the body, and it's at a concentration that has life-threatening effects, and you want to get rid of it. And you wanted to take advantage of this property of ion trapping. What could you do? It's already here. It's in the systemic circulation. Yes, sir? Okay, so you could deal with the absorption angle, somehow treat it so that it's trapped in the gut, and hopefully it would then pass out in the feces and no longer absorbed. But if it's already inside, where could you trap it? You want to get it out of the blood. The tissues are where it's carrying out its pharmacologic properties, including deleterious effects. Well, actually, you know, that's a possibility. No, dialysis is used, actually. It can be used. But we'll come back to that, because there are caveats on when dialysis is more useful than other times. If the drug is here, dialysis is going to be less effective because you've got diffusion rates. You've got to get it out of the tissues and back into the bloodstream so you can get it out. If the blood is predominantly in the vascular compartment, then you can pull it out with diffusion, with dialysis. Ion trapping. There's a picture down there. A kidney. Ooh. Now we're getting close. So what happens? You got a positively charged chemical. It transfers across membranes in the kidney as an uncharged species. It hits the urine. And all of a sudden it becomes protonated. What's going to happen to it? It's going to stay in the urine. It's not going to go back. So ion trapping used to be used extensively in the kidney to enhance elimination of chemicals. You could alkalize the urine. You could acidify the urine. How would you acidify the urine? Some people use ammonium chloride. That would be used in an institutional setting. There are lots of books out still today that talk about hit the patient with vitamin C. Ascorbic acid. It'll acidify the urine. In fact, if you're trying to pass a kidney stone, they tell you to hit it with vitamin C. But guess what? If it's the wrong kind of stone, it's going to exacerbate the problem. And if you're already miserable, that isn't cool. So you got to know what you're dealing with. But no, vitamin C can acidify the urine. Ammonium chloride can acidify the urine. What might you use in an IV to alkalinize the urine? Okay, so bicarb. So there are ways to play the game. And so we've got an example. Somewhere I have an overhead. It's on your handout. Dealing with an amine compound. Let's see, what time is it? Time to take a break. We'll do this after a break. Come back at about 10 after. Some of it gets talked in the individual sections. So, for example, a lot of the new technology with inhalational drugs, I mention in asthma, because they're all used for asthma or COPD. When we're talking about insulins and many of the insulin derivatives in the nasal, or with vasopressin, nasal vasopressin, with a lot of the steroids and the patches, we'll talk about transdermals. And liposomal. Well, the